October 3, 1993. The U.S. Army Rangers are behind enemy lines in the African nation of Somalia, enjoying a rare day off. They are huddled around an upturned wooden crate in a helicopter hangar, taking shelter from the blistering Somali sun. Footsteps start outside on the tarmac, and the large hangar doors open. Standing in the doorway is Platoon Sergeant Sean Watson. The Rangers snap back into action. Their mission, to fly into hostile territory, capture two rebel leaders, and fly them out. It's a routine mission, simple and straightforward, an easy task for the Rangers, who were brought into Somalia for their elite skills and had been conducting missions like this on a regular basis since arriving in Mogadishu.
I think that the task force always had a sense of we were going to go in and do this mission and be successful.
Because we were invincible. We were Superman.
But in a heartbeat, the mission is about to turn into the biggest firefight since the war in Vietnam. And they would find out the hard way that they were not bulletproof. Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top-secret military operations. I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special forces missions to learn about the brave soldiers who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives.
This past weekend, we all reacted with anger and horror as an armed Somali gang desecrated the bodies of our American soldiers.
It was almost that calm before the storm.
Black Hawk down! We got a Black Hawk down!
As told by the people who were there. When a helicopter holding a dozen soldiers went down in the middle of a maze of Somali buildings, the Rangers would leave no man behind, even as enemies closed in from all sides.
The hornet's nest, so to speak, had been stirred up, and we were receiving fire at every intersection.
To survive, this small but mighty fighting force would have to take on an entire army. This is the real story of Black Hawk Down, Part 1. Somalia is a land of great natural beauty. It's located on the east coast of Africa, where miles of white sand beaches are lapped by the turquoise waters of the Indian Ocean. Today, it's a popular tourist destination for its array of national parks and historic sites. But in 1992, Somalia was no vacation paradise. It was a war zone. Rebel groups and clans had fought to overthrow the government. They were now fighting themselves for control of the capital city, Mogadishu. The most powerful group was led by the vicious warlord named Mohammed Adid.
General Adid was a former member of the government that had fallen apart. He was a member of a particular clan that decided to improve and enhance that clan's influence. We have to remember that Somalia was not composed of a particular people, but it was a hodgepodge of varying clans that were vying for power.
Dr. Clayton Chun is the author of Gothic Serpent, Black Hawk Down, Mogadishu, 1993. As Adid's terror and violence raged, hundreds of thousands of Somali civilians were starving.
A third of a million people had died of starvation and disease. Twice that many more were at risk of dying. Meanwhile, tons of relief supplies piled up in the capital of Mogadishu because a small number of Somalis stopped food from reaching their own countrymen.
The operation in Somalia started with George H.W. Bush, then President of the United States. He had seen the vast famine in Somalia, up to 300,000 dead of hunger, starvation, famine. This led to a United Nations mission to help feed and clothe many of the starving individuals there in Somalia.
The White House sent supplies and troops into Somalia to try and avoid further humanitarian disaster. By 1993, the UN effort was fully underway. Many of the UN countries were occupying the capital with the goal of completely disarming the militias. The fighting began to die down, and there was hope for resolution when there was an ambush.
The Pakistanis were used to inspect these authorized weapon storage sites. They would randomly go and check to see whether the sites were broken into or weapons were missing. There was an incident where a mob actually killed 23 Pakistani soldiers. They also captured several other individuals. This led to a very violent, in some regards, uptick of events in Mogadishu.
The killing of the 23 Pakistani soldiers told the UN that there was no way to disarm as long as Adid still had power. They focused more on security and began to plan action against Adid directly. This became known as Operation Gothic Serpent.
Hence, this kicked off a lot of the events of why Task Force Ranger came.
On October 3rd, 1993, the Rangers were taking some free time in their headquarters, an old hangar within the city of Mogadishu. One soldier, Kenny Thomas, was writing a letter home.
Well, it was a Sunday. Sunday was a day off, and we had been going pretty much nonstop for a month and a half. And if we weren't doing real missions, we were out in the sand dunes practicing or training. And so finally on this Sunday afternoon, like, hey, take the day off.
His friend, Randy Ramaglia, was playing a board game.
So I think, we'd had breakfast, had lunch, and we were playing Risk. That was a game that we played. And we were very competitive at it.
When Platoon Sergeant Watson came in.
And the guy walked out of the airplane hangar, which was what our home was, and just yells at us, like, get it on. And it meant that a mission was coming down and you're going to gear, like a firefighter or a police officer gets the call. You gear up and you go and put on your uniform and you go from being a soldier on a day off to being Superman.
For their mission that day, they would be flying to a slum neighborhood in Mogadishu, near the city's Bakara market. At the market, two of Mohammed Adid's officers were in charge of stealing tons of food that had been shipped from the West.
Food, in one regard, was power. Clans would raid food convoys, take food, distribute it to their own members. This then forced the United Nations to look at security measures.
The Rangers were to fly behind the enemy lines, capture the two rebel leaders, and fly them out. Randy and Kenny were optimistic.
It was pretty simple. Once we did capture the targets, we were trucking them out on a convoy to get in, to get our man, and to get out.
We were certainly mentally prepared for it, and we were certainly ready for whatever that they could throw at us. So that wasn't a huge thing that was running through my mind. Oh my gosh, we're going into a bad part of town. Like, didn't matter.
We went where we wanted to go, and there wasn't anyone there that could tell us or make us do otherwise. There simply wasn't.
Capturing the two officials would help alleviate some of the famine, but it also was part of the larger strategy of Gothic Serpent. Dr. Chun.
Original mission to capture the two lieutenants of General Adid really spawned from, in some regards, a target of opportunity. General Adid had basically gone underground. And so some of the thoughts of Task Force Ranger was, if we can't get Adid, let's look for the lieutenants. If you could cut off those leaders, then that would make it very tough for Adid. Either he'd have to surface, or even his standing in the clan would decline because he couldn't operate, and his clan members would see his lieutenants being captured.
For this operation, the Joint Special Operation Forces, or JSOC, put together a special task force made of Army, Air Force, and Navy operators. It was called Task Force Ranger. The force consisted mainly of members from the 75th Ranger Regiment, along with highly trained helicopter teams and members of the secretive Special Forces Unit, Delta Force.
You had individuals that were highly trained, that they had practiced this mission several times on other occasions, six other occasions. They had the firepower, they had the speed, they had the surprise to conduct this mission. So that all those types of characteristics of what you saw in Task Force Ranger that day led to no fear of necessarily a mission that would have problems.
At the hangar, the Rangers were getting into full body armor. The mission had been planned to the last detail. All in all, it was expected to take about an hour. 19 helicopters and 12 vehicles carrying 160 men made their way toward the Bacara Market.
The Bacara Market is almost like an arms bazaar. It has anything that a potential terrorist, militiaman could wish for. You can buy weapons cheap. You had AK-47s. You had weapons from throughout the world that not only could members could buy within Somalia, but other countries were coming in, other terrorists, other groups were coming into Mogadishu to buy weapons. You had plenty of them available. You had whether from the old Soviet supplied regime, but you had weapons from World War II era. You had from old colonialism.
3 miles away, at the American headquarters, senior officers were watching carefully and directing the raid. They were headed by JSOC's leader, two-star General William Garrison.
William Garrison was an expert infantryman. He had served in the Airborne. He had been an advisor in Vietnam. He was also, at one time, a commander of the Delta Force. He then progressed up the chain with Special Operations Forces by being the commander of the Joint Special Operations Command. General Garrison was a very much well-respected in the field of Special Forces.
Garrison had fought battles all over the world for nearly 3 decades. The Rangers were assured they were in good hands.
We certainly had a vibe as to what kind of a man he was. He was a soldier's soldier. He was a soldier's leader. He had come up through the ranks. He was a character. He was always chewing on a cigar and just the kind of man, he was a leader. And you had no doubt following the guy. And he wasn't a general that commanded from some desk in a chair somewhere at the Pentagon. He was always there right among you guys. He'd go out there and play volleyball. He'd come in and watch you train. He'd be the first one waiting for you when you came off the helicopters from a mission, shake your hand, tell you thank you. And he was just a man that he was one of those guys you would follow.
His men were confident, but Garrison was experienced enough to know that as straightforward as this mission was, it was still risky. Mogadishu was in the heart of a territory under a long and bloody civil war, and now it was patrolled by thousands of rebel fighters among a vast network of scorched, hollowed-out buildings.
One of the toughest areas and environment to fight in is an urban area, because you have fortified positions that maybe your enemy could hide in. You have all types of structures that might get in the way of observing where your enemy are located. Speed and surprise was the most important elements of any of these raids. They had to do it fast. If they didn't do it fast, then there's a possibility of crowds would mill about. Whether they were hostile or not, crowds would slow up any vehicle entry or exit into the area, which would then allow clan members to come and fight. If you're flying into an area where an enemy knows that you're looking for a particular location or individual, you could have a shoot down of a helicopter or a blockage of areas so that convoy can't get into the area.
The plan was for the Delta operators to land in MH-6 Little Bird helicopters on the target building. Then they would storm inside and arrest Adid's men. At the same time, the Ranger units, known as Chocks, were going to rope in from hovering Black Hawk helicopters. Chocks 1, 2, 3, and 4 were each responsible for securing a corner of the building and forming a defensive perimeter. The vehicle convoy would then drive up to the target building, pick up the prisoners and the assault team, and bring them back to base. By mid-afternoon, the airborne assault force had maneuvered above the target building. On board, Rangers Kenny and Randy prepared to fast rope in.
So as the birds come into the city, the job of my job in the door of the aircraft was twofold. They said, first, you got to identify the target building. Once you identify the target building, then you kick out the rope. I could look across the street and see the other two helicopters come into a flare. And you could hear gunfire going off, and you could see the Delta operators hitting the rooftop. And then now the bird comes to a stop, hovers, and ropes go out. And you're about 60, 70 feet off the ground, about, you know, to a two- or three-story building, and you're just above the building. So that's about how high you are. Kick the rope out, and then everybody just starts going. And it's a very fast and very efficient way to get people out.
The Rangers saw a few Somali fighters below. But at this point, it still looked like it would be a walkover.
Collette kicked the ropes out. Crew chief spotted to make sure they'd made contact on the ground. He went. I went. The ropes got cut from the helicopters, and the helicopters flew off.
The Rangers hit the ground outside the building where Adid's henchmen were meeting. Each fire team moved into position, ensuring the exits to the building were covered. Kenny looked around him as the dust was beginning to settle. Below, the streets were almost silent. The Delta team broke down the door and moved into the building.
This would take about 15 minutes or so, and then another convoy of Rangers would come up, put them in trucks and other vehicles, and then drive them back to the airport.
A quarter hour in, and the raid was going like clockwork.
Within about a half hour, they brought all the guys out of the building, and we were like, yes, we scored. Like, we knew we had done a good thing. Delta guys brought them out. They tied them up. The trucks drive up. The bad guys on the trucks, and the trucks drive away. And so that left about 80 of us on the target waiting to go home, waiting for our ride.
The special operations mission was a massive success. They had captured the two leaders, and they'd had only one injury, Private Todd Blackburn. The force loaded the prisoners and Blackburn onto the convoy and started to head out. Chalk 3, the Ranger unit that included Kenny and Randy, was waiting near the target building.
It was another Sunday drive home that you would be able to complete the mission and let's go home now, boys.
And it was almost that calm before the storm.
A bullet skimmed the wall behind Randy. He ducked and returned fire.
Pretty much as soon as we assumed our blocking position, I had Private First Class Errico next to me with a saw. And I had him laying on the ground, and I was on a knee, and he kept asking me to get up, and I kept saying, no, stay down. I actually got down, and right after I did, there was machine gun fire directly in front of us. And it was basically a Somali sticking an AK-47 out from around a corrugated steel building. And at that point, I didn't have to tell Erica to fire, but we both engaged the target. And considering what he was behind, I'm certain that we dispatched him. But from then on, it seemed like the volume of firing increased, the intensity of battle increased. You know, it started with one weapon being fired at you from one direction to multiple directions.
We were taking fire early in the battle. You could see, we were looking down the street, and I could see Chalk One guys down there, and they were firing, and you could hear some gunfire going. But, you know, at that point, and I know it feels like bragging, but it really wasn't that bad at that point. It was, and, you know, I joke about it, and I say, well, the reason it wasn't bad is because they were missing.
The rebels weren't very skilled, but they began to accumulate. As their numbers grew, their aim became more accurate. More and more rebel fighters started to appear on side streets besides them and on rooftops above them.
Well, there was a guy, Randy and I both saw him. There was a guy down the road, a couple hundred meters down the road, if even that, and he just kept kind of crossing the street. And he realized he was spotting, and he had a weapon with him. He was kind of hiding it. And our rules of engagement were very strict, and they knew what our rules were. Looking back on it, you can tell, like, they knew exactly what we were allowed to do and what we weren't allowed to do. And their rules were that if they didn't have a weapon, we couldn't shoot at them. So they would hide their weapons. Well, this one guy, we're kind of watching down that road, and basically they would just stick their AK-47s out around the corner and fire off a burst and just spray it. And I'm up against a wall, which is exactly where they tell you not to be because bullets follow the wall, but it just feels more secure.
Kenny peered around the wall and was hit by a bullet.
And all of a sudden, and I described it as it's like Derek Jeter hit you with a baseball bat right in the midsection. And I was on a knee firing down the road, and it hit me right here. Bam, it just knocked me backwards. And two rounds had skipped off the wall, basically, and it hit me.
And I looked over, and Kenny is holding a magazine and shaking his hand because a round had actually impacted his magazine, and the magazine kept that round from going through and hitting him in the chest. Now remember, the width of a magazine is probably no more than an inch. So an inch variance on either side would have been a center mass shot on Kenny.
Hit right in the magazine pouch, which had three magazines in it, and it was smoking, and I thought, it's just like a hot potato. I thought the thing was going to blow up or something. And so I'm pulling the magazine. I looked over across the street, and Randy's over there. He's like almost laughing at me because he must have looked silly to him. But one of the magazines just completely crumbled apart. You know, they're made of metal. And then the other one I still have. And there's a perfect hole in it that's about the size of a dime. And then on the back side, the whole back end of it's blown out. And it's, you're like, wow, it's a game of inches, you know.
It had been a close call, but the relief was only momentary. When they looked up, they saw they were surrounded by dozens of Somali fighters. More and more people were appearing on the roofs above them and in the maze of side roads. The walls and ground in front of them were being relentlessly peppered by AK-47 fire. The entire city seemed to arm up and rush into position. Behind Kenny and Randy, a Blackhawk rose up, their escape route. Triumph, and then disaster.
I looked up and I saw the black smoke coming from the tail section of the Blackhawk, and it went into a spin that it never came out of.
The Blackhawk had been hit by a rocket-propelled grenade and was hurtling to the ground.
Now, I don't remember looking at the bird going, oh my gosh, it's crashing. We knew because the radio, it looked odd. Like, it shouldn't be flying like that. In the back of your mind, you knew that it was going down, but you didn't want to think that. Because it's the same when I try and describe it to people. It's the same feeling that you would get if you went outside in front of your house or something and your family was getting into the car and they got hit by a truck or something. Bam! You're like, oh my gosh, that did not just happen. I can't believe that's happening. And that's what you would say. I can't believe it's happening. But the reality of it is, and with anything that happens in our disasters and floods and death and family problems, the reality is that it is happening.
The routine mission was no longer routine.
And I watched it until I could no longer watch it over the tops of the buildings. I heard an impact. And right after that, you saw masses of people blocks away from us moving in that direction.
The units on the ground fell into position and headed towards the crash site. They had learned a hard lesson about fallen crafts. A few weeks earlier, another unit's helicopter experienced mechanical failure and fell. The pilot and crew were immediately overrun by the mob waiting for them below. All of them were killed.
And we watched those coffins get loaded onto the C-5. And I remember saying, well, it's not going to happen to our guys because the 160th, man, they're not going to get shot down. And these were the Captain Kirks of Army Aviation. They were our heroes, and they weren't going to get shot down. And then there it is. It's getting shot down. And then everything changed. Then it became a whole other mission.
The Black Hawk crashed in the street below. The two helicopter pilots died, but the crew had survived, and the rebel army was beginning to mobilize. As the Rangers watched in horror, the rebels swarmed.
We were aware of what they had done, the previous pilots, crew chiefs, that had been shot down and crashed in the city. And, we clearly didn't want that to happen with our own. And we recognized at that point that we're going to have to go get it.
Don Mann is a former Navy SEAL commander who has been on many high-profile elite special forces missions.
When these Black Hawks went down, the mission expanded because now we had to have our ground forces go and recover the pilots, protect the pilots and the crew, and get them out of there.
At headquarters, General Garrison and his team watched the disaster unfold. The senior officers wasted no time and tasked Lieutenant Larry Moores to plan out how to get the fighting force out of the city.
Very busy, especially once the helicopters are hit and crashed in the city. Everybody's anxiety goes up a notch. We are very focused on doing the right things for the task force. How can we assist in this and be able to evacuate everybody from the city as we're being engaged by the enemy? So they are good at what they do, but it's also something new being injected into an operation that we're conducting. So it's a planning and executing on the fly as mission is changing very drastically from how we originally inserted.
The Somalis started encroaching on the area. They were burning these black tires, which sent black smoke up in the air, meaning it was a signal to everyone else, hey, come help us, come help us here. So they were calling other fighters to this location. They're blocking off the street, they're setting up barricades, setting them up on fire, and plus their target wasn't there. So things started going downhill pretty rapidly.
Now General Garrison has to react. He has to now put in his combat search and rescue team that's on the helicopters. He has to now reroute forces. This is a complete surprise and in some respects a major concern because where the shoot-down occurred. If it was close to the airport or near friendly forces, perhaps not. Maybe if it were located in open fields. But now we're in, again, an urban area that might be very difficult to get forces in and conversely get forces out. You also have now the threat that the Somalis can shoot down helicopters with rocket-propelled grenades in that area.
The situation was all the more difficult because the crash happened deep inside hostile territory. Garrison ordered another helicopter to drop medics and snipers onto the site to buy some time. He diverted the prisoner convoy to pick up the survivors, but no one knew how long the convoy would take to arrive. The trucks began to wind through the city streets towards the crash site, while the Somali mob were closing in on a crashed helicopter. There was no time to hesitate. Garrison mobilized the Rangers and Delta operators that were still on the ground to move to the downed helicopter and form a protective cordon. Chalk 3 were just 500 yards from the crash site.
When you see the bird coming down, we gotta go. The maddening part of it was that they told you, hold up, let's make a quick, get everybody on the same page. And those few minutes that it took before we started moving was insane.
But Task Force Rangers' raid had already stirred up a hornet's nest.
Imagine if somebody had invaded your neighborhood, whether you know the individual or not. The Somalis had seen over their history invasions. They had seen people taking over the city, and now you have Americans that have basically taken some of their citizens, whether they you belong to the Klan or not. So you now have a city enraged. You have individuals that you might find responsible. So whether the helicopter crashes on your own home or whether you have casualties because of previous UN activities that maybe innocent people may have gotten killed, you have this ability now to get revenge. So you Task Force Ranger forces have to contend not only with the Somali militia, but you have individuals that have anger over what's happening to their city to contend with. You have individuals that are just out to find out what was happening. You have individuals that just want to have a fight. So you have a whole mobilized city that could potentially be used against you in at the crash site.
There was a sense of urgency for sure, because you could see all these people that had been shooting at you out of the corners of your eyes. You could see people moving down on the side streets heading towards the crash. So it was a foot race.
It ended up being 160 guys, fighters, fighting 2,000 to 3,000 people is what it ended up being. I mean, in their backyard.
You know, each man goes up to the wall, up to the corner, and you run across. One at a time.
Shoot, move, communicate, put your guys in a position where they can get an effective field of fire, identify the bad guys. It was very automatic. We all knew what we needed to do.
As the American troops moved closer to the crash site, the fire gained ground. Then another tragedy struck. Randy looked over to see a Delta fighter take a direct hit.
I heard like a shrieking yell, and I looked over, and I saw Earl Fillmore, his head flipped back, and he just fell. It was probably the shortest, most violent thing I've ever witnessed. And Lieutenant Lechner was grasping onto his calf. And at that point, you know, you remembered that we really viewed Delta as the supermen. The only thing they didn't have were capes. So to see Fillmore shot and dropped like that was very sobering.
Down on the ground, the Rangers were stranded, with an army of battle-hardened enemy fighters closing in on their position, with nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. As night closed in, their only option was to fight.
It's training up until somebody gets hit. When people start going down and you see how matter-of-fact the death is, you realize, oh, well, if I die here, I die here. But I'm not going to let it happen to the guys around me. Man, we weren't fighting for the flag, and we weren't fighting for freedom, and we weren't fighting for the greater glory of the Ranger Regiment. We really weren't even fighting for our families and friends back home. At this point, you're fighting for each other.
In the next episode, as the Rangers made their way towards the downed Blackhawk, smoke from above signaled the last thing they were expecting, a second hit Blackhawk.
The one weapon that was most dangerous to the American forces was rocket-propelled grenades. They're very cheap. They're very easy to use. A propellant charge that could destroy a vehicle or that could damage a helicopter.
That's next time on Covert. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It's produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley and Rachel Jacobs and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had editing help by David Markowitz, with additional production from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa and Damian Thorpe. Special thanks in this episode to Rob Peterson. David McNabb is the series' creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. Don't forget to follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review.